Hello, dear friends. How are you doing today? I'm Mark Golub. It's always wonderful to be with you for another Gam Yachad, together during COVID-19. And the news seems mixed these days. For a number of possible reasons, the number of people who are testing positive is rising, in some parts of the country rather dramatically. At the same time, the number of people needing hospitalization, even more significantly, the number of deaths from the virus has not been anywhere near the numbers in the early months of the disease, in March, April, even into May. And in fact, the number of deaths continues to drop. And those testing positive tend to be younger people whose immune systems and overall health tend to make the virus far less threatening. But for many of us who are not in the medical world and who are in the most vulnerable demographic, there are still many unanswered questions and many anxieties and fears. So one of the things we try to do on JBS is to speak to some of the leading experts in the field, to learn from them as we all navigate this most uncomfortable and trying period. And I'm honored to have such an individual with us on this edition of Gam Yachad, Dr. David Katz, the founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center. Dr. Katz is a world-renowned expert in nutrition and diet. Dr. David Katz has published 18 books, in addition to his hundreds of scientific articles and textbook chapters, and he holds multiple medical patents. In addition to serving as the Director of Medical Studies in Public Health at the Yale School of Medicine, David Katz has been an adjunct professor at George Washington University of Medicine and is the recipient of 3 honorary doctorate degrees. But the mark of someone truly outstanding in his field is how one's colleagues regard him. And among his peers, David Katz is recognized as the Poet Laureate of Health Promotion. And David Katz, thank you so much for making time for us on JBS.
Well, Mark, it's good to be Yachad. And my mother would have loved every word of that intro, so thank you for that.
You're most welcome. And by the way, before we talk about the coronavirus, give us a sense of your own Jewish background and identity.
Well, I am definitely part of the Klan. As a Katz, presumably, you know, Kohen Tzedek and all of that. I am, as a man of science, not overly inclined toward faith. I like to probe what I don't understand, and you know, I tend to address it analytically. So am I a great Jew? Probably not, but raised with the traditions, proud of the heritage. It's always been important to my family to recognize the traditions. And my wife is actually from a very interesting branch of the tribe. So I'm Ashkenazi. She's Sephardic. She probably originally from Spain, and probably her family, we guess, was chased from Spain during the Inquisition and landed in North Africa, where she was born. So she was actually born in Algeria and raised French in a North African nation, and then had to leave there when she was 2 years old because of the revolution there. So a classic representation of the unending Jewish diaspora.
That is lovely. And how do you know, what makes you devote your life in terms of your professional career to diet, nutrition, and preventive medicine?
So preventive medicine is the first part of the answer. My dad's a cardiologist and, you know, set a beautiful example for me growing up. I mean, here was somebody who, you know, was working really hard and saving lives. And you know, as a kid, I watched that and I just admired him and I admired what he was doing. And when it was my turn to figure out what to do in the world, I thought, well, saving lives, that's a really good calling. Maybe I can do that too. Maybe I can be on that team.
That's wonderful.
And so I went to, I decided I'd go to med school and follow in my dad's footsteps and went to medical school and then trained in internal medicine. But I'm a lot like my dad, but also very different. My dad, can sort of focus and do the thing right in front of him. I am always scanning the horizon. I just can't help it. I'm always looking at the big picture. So when I trained in internal medicine, you're in the hospital for 100 hours a week then or more. And I was overcome by the fact that easily 8 out of 10 people in hospital beds who were desperately sick were never going to be truly vital again. I thought, I'm learning how to be one of the king's horses and king's men. Basically, Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall, the shell is cracked, we're patching it together, but we're never going to get these people who've had heart attacks and strokes and cancers and so forth and amputations back to what their health and vitality might have been had they gotten the formula right in the first place, had they not smoked, had they eaten well, had they been active. Wow, I really want to be involved in that. Maybe I can help the next cohort not wind up in the hospital in the first place. So I, after completing my training in internal medicine, went to Yale in 1991 to train in preventive medicine. And the rest, as they say, is history. So, basically combined clinical practice for about 30 years with the public health focus on empowering populations to stay healthy in the first place. And that, by the way, Mark, is, how I got so involved in the COVID response, because it's that same big picture thinking. And although I focused on diet nutrition because that's, if you look at health in America, that's where the action is. So basically three things account for 80% of the premature deaths in our country every year. Forget about the pandemic. Year in, year out. Tobacco, poor diet, lack of physical activity. And of the three, diet is now number one. Poor diet quality alone kills 500,000 people prematurely in the U.S. every year. So, yes, it's a terrible toll that COVID has caused 120,000 deaths in the United States this year as a one-time tragic toll. But diet kills more than four times that many prematurely every year. And in addition to all of those it kills, it hurts many others, including our kids who are subject to epidemic obesity, type 2 diabetes, and so forth. So I focused on that because it's where the action is. And then during the pandemic, I focused on COVID because right now it's where the action is. It's where people's anxieties are, and I want to help there too.
You talk about your own Jewish identity. Most of us are really secular Jews in America. There are many observant Jews who are Orthodox, conservative, reform, reconstructionist, whatever. And they take it seriously, and it means an awful lot to them. But the majority of American Jews are still basically secular Jews, and they have a strong sense of Jewish identity, and it's expressed in one way or another. And I want, as you talked about what drove you into medicine and how you want to be where the action is, and you were sensitive to the pain of people who were in beds who may never, even if they left the hospital, they never would be the same. In the Jewish tradition, the doctor is revered. And it's not simply the joke, what is my son the doctor because of the money. From earliest times on, the Jewish people and the Jewish tradition has been devoted to healing. It's seen as an extension of the divine. Mm-hmm. And Maimonides says that the very first thing a community should create whenever it creates a new community is a hospital, and that it's all about not praying necessarily for health, but to going to somebody like you and other, really wonderful, sensitive physicians who understand what healing is all about. So I want you to know, as you described yourself, observance aside, you are so much of what makes the Jewish community proud. And it really is, I'm even happier to have you on JBS. And now I want to ask you my question that comes out of how you described what concerns you. When you say diet is responsible for the most death of the three, it was diet, heart disease, and what?
No, well, the lifestyle factors are diet, tobacco, lack of physical activity. For ease of recollection, bad use of feet, forks, and fingers.
Okay.
80% of the premature deaths in our country, just those three things, but diet's number one.
Okay, so when you say a bad diet, David, what's a bad diet?
Well, first of all, Mark, again, thank you for the lovely words. And, you know, having done patient care for just about three decades, I no longer do. I'm now focused on public health, although I went back. I volunteered in New York City, so I did a number of shifts, several shifts in an emergency department in the Bronx during the COVID crisis. But that was the first time I'd done hospital care in several years. But, first of all, I revere it too, to have the training to be able to help in those moments of desperation is a really special, beautiful thing. It's also incredibly indelible. It's such a great privilege, to be the one to help people through the moments of greatest duress and challenge. So anyway, I share that reverence for the field of medicine.
I appreciate your saying so.
So bad diet can be defined in lots of complicated ways, but I think it's almost as simple as you know it when you see it, right? So if you're eating real food, mostly plants, so if your diet is mostly made up of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds, if everything else is in relatively modest portion, if when you're thirsty, you mostly drink plain water, you're getting it right. And then that basic framework can be parlayed into almost any diet you like. It certainly can be kosher. It can be Mediterranean. It can be flexitarian. It can be pescatarian. It can be vegetarian. It can be vegan. It can be paleo. It can be low fat. It can be low carb. Those are all variants on the theme. But the theme is genuine food. So food identifiable from nature, not frankenfood manufactured from glow-in-the-dark bits. And plant predominant. It's simple, really, what a good diet is. And the further you migrate away from there, the worse your diet is. So if it's mostly made up of highly processed food, if a lot of what you eat has ingredient lists that run off the package, if you turn off the lights and your food glows in the dark, and if a lot of your food is the product of factory farming, which, by the way, is abusive to the environment, involves cruelty to animals, and produces stuff that's not good for us to eat, your diet's not so good. I left Yale after just about 30 years to run a startup company, Diet ID. I encourage people to check it out. We've reinvented dietary assessment and tracking as a tool to help people get to the diet that they want to have. And there we have 15 types of diets that represent the range of dietary activity in America and 10 tiers of quality for each. And when we look at that map of the nation's diets, there are really two key shifts that indicate the flow from bad to good. As you go from highly processed food to minimally processed food in its native state, diets get better, better when you measure diet quality objectively. And as you go from animal food predominant, so lots of meat, processed dairy, to less of that and more vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds, diet quality gets better. So it's pretty simple. My latest book, I think it's the 19th book, actually, with Mark Bittman, How to Eat. And this came out just a few months ago. Sadly for us, it came out just as the pandemic was saying, everybody in this country is fascinated with diet all the time, except when in the midst of a coronavirus right. pandemic. So bad timing. But we go into all the details of what really is a good diet and what about grains and what about beans and what about coffee and what about fish and what about meat and what about game and what about dairy and what about eggs and all that. But at the end, we reach a conclusion, that you pretty much knew what a healthy diet was before we even started talking. Come on, be honest.
And in some way, for this particular moment in history, the bus has left the station. We are now who we are, and all we can do is, as we listen to you, try to decide the extent to which we want to modify our diet. And I want to have you back, David, and just talk about your work in that area. But the truth is, I need to talk to you about COVID.
Okay,
right.
Deal.
In a moment, I want to talk about some of the social issues attended to the virus. But first, I want to ask you a basic question. And again, While the viewing audience of JBS includes people of all ages, David, the majority of our viewers are in the older and more vulnerable demographic. And so there's a lot of anxiety and fear among people who are 60 and 70 and 80 and 90, many, if not all of whom, have other underlying health conditions. Who doesn't at 80?
Right.
So one of the things I have especially tried to do is delineate the dangers and to allay fears wherever appropriate. That said, David, are the three rules still the basis of a person staying safe? Namely, wearing a mask, social distancing, washing hands upon coming home, and keeping your hands away from your mouth, nose, and eyes. If we follow those rules, should people feel safe? Should we feel safe that it is very unlikely we would get the virus? Or, sadly, is it more complicated?
It's not much more complicated, Mark. It's a little bit complicated by, are you indoors or outdoors? Is the sun shining or not? Are you with a large group of people? Is there a high likelihood that the group of people you are interacting with is a source of the virus in the first place? You can't get it if nobody around you has it to give it to you. Which part of the country are you in? Are you in a part of the country where there's a lot of viral circulation or a part where there's less and less? And on it goes. In general, though, actually, it's interesting. My day started reviewing for someone else an infographic. Initially, they sent me a version with numbers, and then they just sent me a version that I like better with an ordinal scale. And it shows pictures of two faces, so as if these two people are talking to one another. And the person A has coronavirus, person B does not and can get it. And in the first instance, nobody's wearing a mask, and we would call the risk of transmission if they're having a face-to-face conversation fairly high. In the second version, the person with coronavirus is not wearing a mask, but the person who's at risk is wearing a mask to protect themselves, and the risk there is moderate. And in the third version, the person with coronavirus is wearing the mask, the person without coronavirus is not, and the risk is fairly low. And in the final version, both are wearing a mask, and the risk is very low. And one step beyond that, they're both wearing a mask and they're 6 feet apart, and the risk is vanishingly low. In other words, it's not going to happen. So yeah, simple stuff can make an enormous difference. My parents are both 80. They're in the high-risk group. And the other thing that we're looking at is in Connecticut, where we live, viral circulation is falling asymptotically toward zero. We're not at zero yet, but it's very low. So there's low-level viral exposure to be had in our state because the Northeast has had its first wave. And they're being careful, and we're social distancing. And you know, if we know, members of the family, that we've had no outside exposures, then we're starting to relax. I hugged my mom for the first time.
Really?
So go, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we were hands off, 6 feet away, sit outside. You know, if you get too close, wear a mask, you know, even within the family. But I said, yeah, I haven't been exposed. I'm fine. You're fine. How about a hug? And she said, oh, God, have I been waiting for that?
That is wonderful. That is wonderful.
So, but yeah, those basic precautions really do work. And if you couple that with some general, let's call it situational awareness. Where are you in the country? If there's lots of viral exposure, be very, very fastidious. If you're in a place where there's almost no virus circulating, you can't get it if nobody around you has it. And so your risk is already low. And what we're talking about is the relative risk. And, you know, at some point, the risk is close enough to zero that you say, you know, I can relax the precautions. The risk will never be completely zero, but close enough. I mean, you know,
I understand.
Yeah.
But nobody can guarantee anything. But
you know what's required to be at some risk of dying today? There's just one requirement. Living today. That's the only thing required to be at some risk of dying today. There doesn't need to be a pandemic, right? So we never get to a zero risk scenario. We just don't.
Okay. But we really told you, all right, we're talking about dying from the pandemic.
Right. And we're talking about, you know, managing risk so that it's so low, it need not be a preoccupation. Okay. These simple precautions.
I think it's very comforting for the JBS audience to hear what you have to say. So I'm and you say it both Well, but there's nuance to it, so I appreciate it. And then I want to ask you, just a couple of questions. And David, there seems to be a difference of opinion periodically. I want to know where you think we are now. How likely is it that a person can contract the virus by touching a surface where someone with the disease has already touched that surface?
With any infectious disease, what determines whether or not you get infected, whether or not you get sick, is the dose of exposure.
The
And although we
dose,
know the dose of
how
exposure,
much?
yeah, because, and I have a quick analogy, Mark, to help people understand this. So again, do it very briskly. But, Matt, you're defending a compound with a security force. Your compound is assaulted by a haggard band of a few scruffy mercenaries. You repel them, you barely notice they showed up, and you go back and have lunch. Okay, that's scenario one. Scenario two, you're assaulted by a much more robust band that matches your own security force pretty evenly. There's a real tussle, there's some hurt on both sides, but you carry the day. And the third scenario is same compound, same security force, massive army storms your perimeter, overwhelms you, and you are undone. Well, your compound is the body, your security force is your immune system, and the assaulting army, of course, is the virus. It's exactly how it works. If you have the same virus, but just a few viral particles, you repel them, you don't even make antibodies. It actually all happens right on the mucous membranes. It never really even gets into your bloodstream. The second scenario, it gets into your bloodstream, but you don't get terribly sick. The third scenario, you get terribly sick and are at risk of dying. That's how it works. So although it's theoretically possible to get coronavirus from surfaces, so someone coughs or sneezes, it lands on a surface, you touch the surface, some number of viral particles are now on your fingers, you touch your face, you can get it. We actually have no clear evidence that anybody has gotten it that way. So we know it's possible, but the entry-level risk is low. And then if you're careful what you do with your hands, if you wash your hands frequently, if when you're out and about, you're careful not to touch your face, or when you're out and about, you're wearing a mask so that if you touch your face, you touch the mask as opposed to your nose, the risk is very, very small.
Very, very helpful. I think it therefore makes some of the other questions I have almost moot. I want to come back though to the picture you studied earlier today where there were two people talking to each other and one had the virus, the other didn't, and the question is, under what circumstances was it likely that the virus would be communicated? One of the things that I've heard, I want to hear your reaction to it, is that it's not simply are you in some kind of proximity with someone who has the virus, but how long are you in proximity? And that if you're not in proximity for a certain length of time, while again, there's no guarantees, it's not a question of zero, but the chances of getting the disease are relatively small. Do you agree with that?
I do, but again, with nuance and proviso. So, if you and I are face to face, I have COVID and I sneeze on you, I don't need to be near you for very long. I just long enough to sneeze on you. You're probably in trouble. On the other hand, if I am 4, 5, 6 feet away, I have COVID, I'm being careful, you're being careful. But we have a long animated conversation and a little bit of the virus that I carry gets into the air each time I talk. And then this goes on for, we were having an intense Talmudic discussion, you and I, and this goes on for hours. Then, essentially there's an accumulation of your exposure over that time. And again, it's the viral load you're exposed to that will determine whether or not you get sick. So absolutely. Duration matters. The nature of the exchange matters. Is it animated? Am I gesticulating and spewing droplets into the air? Or, are we having a very calm conversation? Am I shouting? Am I singing? Where we've seen super spreader events, one of those is in groups singing together, church choirs, for example. You have to be really careful. Everybody's mouth is wide open. When you sing, a lot more droplets get into the air than when you just talk. Are we indoors or outdoors? Because in this, as in all things, daylight is an excellent disinfectant. It kills the virus. So if you're outdoors in bright sunlight, okay. I think a 2-hour conversation 6 feet apart outdoors in bright sunlight, we're sitting at opposite ends of a bench, actually much less dangerous than 3 minutes close together indoors without the sunlight, right? So there are a whole lot of it depends. in general, duration matters.
Very. Where did you hug your mother?
At her house.
But it's okay.
I think so. Okay. I don't have COVID, and she's been very careful. You know, I basically, it had been more than 2 weeks since I'd had any exposure to a potential source. I couldn't have the virus.
How do you feel about people going to supermarkets?
You know, I think, first of all, we have to go about our lives. And, you know, if you don't go shopping, you need somebody who can do it for you. But I do think food is important.
That's not an answer. That's not it. So, you've already taught me. I want to stay safe and I want to stay alive. Yeah, I want to know if going to a supermarket is dangerous.
It should not be because of what you do and what the store does. So what the stores are doing is crowd control for the most part. Some of them are offering select hours for people in the higher risk groups where they have an even more rigorous crowd control, so very sparse population. So you can reliably stay at least 6 feet apart. You wear a mask. Everybody else wears a mask. We're talking about a very low risk situation. In terms of viral transmission via the food products in the store, somebody touched it, you buy it, again, vanishingly low risk. I really am, you know, just wash your hands routinely, be careful about touching your face, wear a mask, and that's more than sufficient. You do not need to disinfect the items, per se, that you bring home from the supermarket.
Okay. How do you feel about outdoor restaurants?
Again, they are all practicing social distancing. They've spaced their tables apart. I think that's fine. However, I would take into consideration the part of the country you're in. So I think it's fine for my parents in Connecticut to start returning, which, you know, they haven't had that opportunity for the past couple months. But I think they can now go to a restaurant and eat outdoors. I'd be really careful in Florida, Arizona, Texas, and California right now, just because with a higher level of transmission among young people who are likely to be at that restaurant, if more people around you have the virus, you are not going to be wearing a mask while eating. It's really inconvenient to try and eat while wearing a mask. So your mask will be off, and if there's virus on all sides of you, okay, 6 feet between tables, but they've got it. You know, it's a higher risk situation. So I would say it's a combination of what the venue is doing, what you can do, and the epidemiology in the part of the country. And I don't think you should ignore that third one. I'd be really careful when the virus is circulating at high levels near where you are. I'd be more careful then.
Okay, how do you feel about beauty parlors and barbershops?
You know, again, somewhat similarly in terms of likelihood of exposure, but I think as long as the person doing the I finally got a professional haircut. My hair had gotten hopelessly out of control. I reached the
Where
point
did you get your haircut?
Jose down the street cut my hair. But first of all, I was wearing hats. Then I finally took a razor and said, I'm just going to shave my own head, which I kind of did. And then I finally got into Jose who fixed it.
Good for Jose.
But Jose wore a mask and was very careful and sanitized his hands before and immediately after. I wore a mask. I felt very safe. I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. I did a questionnaire at entry. Any symptoms? No. So neither of us could have any symptoms. Nobody in the shop could have any symptoms. All of the hygienic practices were in place. I think it's safe.
Do you order food from a restaurant? Order in? You know, not going to a restaurant, but you would eat food prepared in a restaurant?
Yes.
Okay. And how do you feel about people, I assume the same way, how do you feel about people going to stores, you know, to Target and to Apple and to the hardware store and the clothing store?
Yeah, so about the same way as at the supermarket, careful about crowd control. You really, you know, obviously you just want to avoid super spreader events where, you know, you're gathered with lots of people likely to be harboring the virus who are not taking precautions. Those are the dangerous situations.
By the way, when you say that, were you surprised that there seems to be, and maybe I'm wrong, for weeks, there were thousands of people in the streets of New York, I'm sorry, in the streets of America, in various cities across the country. And then as we're talking, it was yesterday that there was the annual gay parade in Chicago, thousands of people together. And do you say to yourself as a physician, I understand what's motivating people, both in terms of the protests over a hideous, horrendous murder. And yeah. I understand why the gay community wants to march in a gay parade, but there's something silly about it. Do you say that to yourself, or in some way, is it okay?
So I feel differently about the two. So first of all, you know, large gatherings, animated people yelling, shouting, cheering, chanting, you know, significant potential risk. And then, of course, when the protests turned violent and the police got involved and people had to, you know, take their masks off so they could breathe and so forth, things got worse. So in general, if you're looking at the best way to end the policy response to a pandemic, it would not be massive street demonstrations of any kind. Right. But I do feel differently about the two. I'm supportive of both causes, obviously racial justice and social justice in our country. And that really extends to both the protests in the aftermath of George Floyd's death and also the gay pride. But the gay pride event is a scheduled event that, you know, it's annual. It could be rescheduled. And so in any given part of the country, I would say, you know, think about risk. I mean, after all, we're iconic events like the New York Marathon are being postponed or canceled. The Olympics were moved. You would say this, you know, this is potentially putting people at risk that they don't need to face. And if particularly if the age range of participants is very broad, we might want to reschedule. The protests are another story. You know, you protest when your passions are inflamed because of what just happened. I don't really think there was much choice. I think the time to protest is when the injustice is being perpetrated. So, you know, I'm completely sympathetic to both causes. I think they're both very worthy. I think one had more discretion in terms of timing than the other. But actually, you know, particularly the demonstrations in the Northeast, it doesn't look like they did very much to increase viral transmission. And I think I know why. And that's because most people prone to get this thing in our part of the country have already gotten it. And by the way, Mark, I want to throw something in the mix. I think this is really important. And I don't want to overstate it because it's an impression based on data. My colleagues are very divided on this topic, although I see more and more little by little coming over to my side of the argument. I think somewhere between 50 and 80% of the general population is natively resistant to SARS-CoV-2. Not perfectly resistant. You know, if you get a massive exposure, you'll get it. If you're doing procedures in the ICU, you can get it. But if you just have a casual exposure because somebody else on the subway has it, you're not going to get it. Only somewhere between 20 and 50% of the general population is particularly prone to get this, even if they're meaningfully exposed. And what I think that means is if you've got half or more of the population with native resistance, and then 20% or so make antibodies, you've reached herd immunity. I think New York City is herd immune. I don't know how long it'll last. I don't know that it's perfect. And again, I state this with all due humility. I don't know this is the case, but it is my impression based on many, many data sources suggesting that even with considerable exposure, only about 20% of people get it. You know where that was true? It's true in New York, where 60% of people ride the subway and so did the coronavirus. But it was true on the Diamond Princess cruise ship where everybody was exposed, only 20% got infected. It was true on the USS Theodore Roosevelt where everybody, all the sailors were exposed, only 20% got it. It was true in a hard-hit province in Iran called Guilan that resulted in a publication looking at seroprevalence. It was true in New York City. And we've seen papers now come out explaining the mechanism where it looks like other coronaviruses we've all been exposed to because they cause the common cold may actually confer a partial immunity to this coronavirus. So many people may have a partial native resistance, and that means we may be much further through this than we had cause to think. And that's why the protests in the Northeast didn't do much to spread the virus, because everybody who was going to get it already got it.
By the way, first, it's a fascinating analysis. It's interesting to hear you say that more of your colleagues are coming over to that position. But David, it is a comforting thing to think about it, the extent to which you could be right. A lot of people, and again, this doesn't mean we stop doing, you know, we don't stop following the rules, but it would be nice to feel that in some way the worst is over and that we're over the hump and things are getting better. And the reason why I wanted to talk to you so much right now is there's a lot of debate over whether the opening up of our society across the United States was appropriate. Is it appropriate now? Should the lockdown come to an end? Should it not come to an end? And that there are, there are people who are arguing on both sides of the issue. And so I wanted to hear what David Katz had to say. And it sounds to me, and then you'll nuance it again, it sounds to me that a lot of it has to do with where in the country the lockdown is taking place. It sounds to me like you feel a responsible lockdown, a responsible end to the lockdown, which involves wearing a mask, which still involves social distancing, which involves taking care of keeping your hands away from your mouth, nose, and eyes, that in a place like New York or Connecticut, where the numbers are down significantly, you would be more comfortable with an end to the lockdown, and that in other parts of the country, you would not. But I do want to hear you speak to the philosophical issue in general. Sure. Are we at a moment now, David, where ending the lockdown is appropriate?
So just before I answer that, and I promise I will, just to back it up, I want people to know that beyond what I can hope to say in the next few minutes, we have a massive archive of information, risk models, peer-reviewed papers, columns, essays, blogs, infographics, everything you might like. They're both at my website, davidkatzmd.com, but the best source is my nonprofit, the True Health Initiative. So True Health Initiative, just Google that. We have a dedicated COVID page and all this material. And what you'll see there is the header says total harm minimization. So first, Mark, what I've argued for from the very beginning of this, this is what landed me on the pages of the New York Times and situated me repeatedly in Tom Friedman's column and brought me more notoriety than I really wanted, to be honest, was this idea that you really want to look both ways. It can hurt people to get this virus. If you're elderly, if you have chronic disease, if your health is frail, getting this virus is really bad. By the way, if you are young and healthy, getting this virus is not all that bad for the most part. On the other hand, it's really bad to lose your job. It's really bad to be hungry. It's really bad to be desperate and destitute and not know if you can put food on the table and depressed and all sorts of bad things happen there. What I did at the beginning was say, I don't want to just look one way and then dash across the street. I'm going to do what my mom taught me to do. I'm going to look both ways before I cross the street. Yeah, that can hurt people. That's bad. We want to prevent that. That can also hurt people. That's also bad. We want to prevent that. How do we do that? And the answer seemed to me then and seems to me now, these many weeks or lifetimes, whatever it is later, vertical interdiction, risk-based interdiction. What we've been discussing, you told me, you know, we have an audience here that spans the age range, but in particular, lots of people who are in the older groups who are at higher risk. You need to be very careful, like my parents. But honestly, if you're young and healthy, if you're under 50 and in good health, I don't think what you need to worry about is don't transmit the virus to your parents. Don't transmit the virus to your friends who are not in good health. But other than that, this is not that big a deal. Overwhelmingly, people under 50 in good health get this, get over it. You know, half of them have no symptoms at all, don't even know they had it. Most have mild symptoms. It's just not that big a deal. But that's, again, you're in good health and you're younger. We really need to worry at the interface of people in the low-risk group with people in the high-risk group. And those of us in the lower-risk group, our obligation is always to accommodate the people in our lives in the higher-risk groups. Okay. So given that, I don't think we've done anything right in the United States. I think we locked down way too much, way too haphazardly. I don't think we needed to shut down universities. I don't think all the kids needed to be kept out of school. But if we needed time to figure out, okay, how do we do a risk-based strategy? Okay, we're going to lock everything down for a few weeks. We're going to gather data to see who gets this thing, who makes antibodies, who gets symptoms and who doesn't, who gets hospitalized and who doesn't, who winds up in the ICU and who doesn't, and who dies and who doesn't. And when we know that, we'll be informed about risk. And by the way, we can collect all those data in a small representative random sample. We don't need millions of tests. We can do 50,000, get all the information we need to inform what's going on nationally. And then we can decide, okay, what needs to be closed down? What can stay open? There's stuff that could have stayed open all along. So you're asking me about reopening. There's stuff we never needed to shut down in the first place. We did it haphazardly, but okay. We should now be opening up in a risk stratified manner. And everything we've talked about, if there are arrangements in place in terms of government regulations, site-specific practices, and your understanding of how best to protect yourself, if they allow for younger, robust people to go out to the world, maybe get exposed to the virus, shrug their shoulders and say, if I get it, I get it, but to have protections in place so that they do not transmit it to their parents or their grandparents, then it is not too early to open up. On the other hand, we've seen virtually no evidence of that level of coordination or cogent thinking in our country. And given the choice between lock everything, you know, in the cellar and wait for a vaccine, or everybody in the water right away, never mind the riptides and the sharks, grandma will be fine. You know, if those are the choices, then no, it's not a good time to send grandma into the water with the riptides and the sharks. Certainly not in Arizona, Florida, Texas, California, those parts of the country, which, by the way, are not having a second wave. They're having the first wave. And why are they having the first wave now? Because they locked everybody in bunkers before the virus really got a hold there, and now they're letting everybody out haphazardly. People can go out. People can get it. And you started the discussion by noting that the case counts are rising, and that's partly because the virus is spreading. It's partly because we're doing more testing. And hospitalization and deaths are not rising. Unfortunately, in Texas, they are. Houston hospitals were near capacity. But if that's the case, if we see rising case counts in young people and the young people are being responsible about not transmitting to older people, then that's fine. I think that's actually, that will get us to herd immunity. That's a healthy process. But it's the vulnerable people that concern me. It's too soon to open up and assume that if you're in a higher risk group, you don't have to be extremely careful. Mm-hmm. You do.
By the way, that was such a cogent, thoughtful analysis. And this has nothing to do with politics in America, left and right in America. David, I have not heard people of your stature saying it the way you have said it. And I didn't hear it from, you know, the top medical people in our country. And again, I this is not about politics at all. I'm asking a different kind of question. Do you have any sense of why it was that the kind of thoughtful approach was not implemented anywhere in America as you've described it?
Most scientists, because science advances with reductionism, are really taught to look through a tunnel at the small parts of the small parts. And in a global crisis, that's very unhelpful. And I, although I am a scientist and I ran a research lab at Yale for over 20 years, my interest has always been the big picture. So I step back, you know, where we have a famous expression, missing the forest for the trees. I always see the forest. Sometimes it's a liability, but I think in a situation like this, it's an asset. So, for example, I know a lot about infectious disease outbreaks and the epidemics that have plagued public health, but I also care a lot about social determinants of health and, you know, what unemployment can do to people's lives and health. So I was one of the few people looking at both and saying either is a potential path to the ruin of human health and human potential, and I care about both. I think too many people, you know, we're so hyper-specialized. I'm a virologist. All I care about is the infectious disease. I'm an economist. All I care about is jobs. No, I'm a humanist. I care about any which way people get hurt and any which way we can help them.
So, David, when will we have a vaccine?
No idea. Nobody has a clue. And that, you know, that's a really important issue. So, you know, the idea that we can shut down society while waiting for a vaccine is a fool's errand. We've been working on an HIV vaccine for 40 years. We still don't have one. And while nobody thinks that SARS-CoV-2 will be as difficult as HIV, we don't know for sure that it won't be. So, you know, there is in the mix of projections about when we'll have a vaccine, one of the items that has to be on the list is never, right? So, you know, we're hoping that's not the case. But the idea that we can have a highly effective, very safe, mass-produced, universally distributed vaccine, and that's how we get back to the world? Wow, that's a very high bar to clear.
All right. By the way, I have a daughter who's a professor at Hunter and who is very, very much involved in HIV protocols to keep people healthy. And while there is no vaccine, there is now a cocktail.
Yes.
And people do not die from HIV in general.
Right.
So the other question is, if there's no vaccine, will there be a drug or a combination of drugs that will be effective in keeping people from getting really, really sick or from dying? And, you know, right now there's a lot of talk about remdesivir. I want to know your sense of the landscape in general as it applies to drugs. And what do you think of remdesivir, hydroxychloroquine, and any other drugs that you know about which give you some optimism?
Yeah. So will there be a cure, you know, some treatment where nobody dies? I don't know. Nobody knows. It's not on the horizon. Will there be massive improvements in our ability to treat this disease so many fewer people die? Already happened, and getting better by the day. So that's an easy, absolute yes. When I deployed in the Bronx, the treatment protocols were radically different from the week before. I've never seen that in my entire clinical career. My colleagues there who worked in that emergency department full-time said, we're doing, so, you know, welcome. Thanks for volunteering. Glad to have you. Here's what we do. By the way, we weren't doing this last week. And that included things like we tried like hell not to intubate people, not to put them on ventilators. We repositioned them. I saw that work. Everybody was getting a drug called apixaban to prevent blood clots. If they had markers, and everybody had this panel of laboratory tests, which was different from a week before, we knew what to test for. If they had markers indicating that their blood clotting system was activated, they got this drug to prevent blood clots from forming. Everybody was getting a high dose of steroids. What's been in the news lately is dexamethasone. That's a steroid. Colleagues I was working with already knew that a high-dose steroid for people who had certain markers in their blood, very helpful. Remdesivir is a very effective treatment for people prone to the cytokine storm. It squelches, to some extent, the excessive immune system activity. And by the way, being generally healthy beforehand, the things we talked about early in the conversation all make a big difference there, too. But absolutely, it's an effective part of the treatment. And hydroxychloroquine appears not to work. It was an interesting mechanism. It looked like it had promise. But, you know, despite all of the debate back and forth about what the research said, didn't say, the meta-analyses that have looked at all of the clinical data so far show no difference with hydroxychloroquine. So it does not appear to be helpful. And it is a drug that can be dangerous to the heart. So it's not recommended. But overall, the percent of people who are sick enough to be hospitalized who survive is much higher than it was at the beginning of the pandemic and gets higher by the week. So I'm very, very optimistic.
Is that because the medical world understands how to treat it better than it did when it first appeared?
Yes. Clinicians around the world and researchers around the world are sharing information at a remarkable pace. There's some dangers with that. So some stuff that's not really ready for prime time gets shared prematurely. But mostly what happens is everybody learns about everybody else's advances and innovations. They become the new normal. And so essentially we keep climbing from a higher base camp. And by the day, the treatment protocols for COVID are improving. So very, very optimistic about how that will continue to evolve. And that's an established trajectory. Unlike the vaccine where there's so many unknowns, this is already making a big difference.
By the way, so you see my age, and I have underlying health problems. Everybody my age does. My wife has an issue. So, and I'm your father now, David. I'd be very proud to have you as a son. So I'm your father. I'm your uncle. And now you've got to tell your uncle here, at what point is your uncle going to be able to return to some form of normalcy? And you're now speaking to a large percentage of the JBS audience. That's their question. How long am I going to be stuck here? All right, so, David Katz, what do you say?
So my point of view is, you know, first of all, as we've discussed, there are three main considerations. What is the situation around you? Is there lots of virus or very little? What precautions are being taken by the places you might go, and what precautions can you take personally? When the level of viral circulation around you is low and falling, and places are taking precautions and you're taking precautions, you're safe out in the world. The precautions can disappear. So if normalcy means, hey, I don't have to be careful anymore, I would say when that's when viral circulation in your part of the world, wherever that happens to be, is near zero. You know, that can be some defined numerical threshold, you know, a certain number of cases per state per day or per week, or, you know, number of new cases per 10,000 population per week. And those various numerical cut points, you know, could all be defended. But in general, you know, I look at the trend in Connecticut, it's an asymptote. I mean, we basically, you know, we had our first wave, we had a spike in cases, it's falling. Little bit of fluctuation now, probably because of street protests and so forth, but getting really, really close to zero. I tell my parents, you know, if only a couple hundred people in the whole state have this thing, and we've got several million people living in the state, your likelihood of running into COVID is like the likelihood of winning the lottery. It's just not something you're going to spend your time worrying about. Come back out to the world. So no, you're not waiting for a vaccine. I think it's low-level viral transmission. And you know, again, while the virus is still out there and reasonably prevalent, be careful. If you're in an at-risk group, you can still come out to the world, but just be careful, take those precautions, and you can dial back the precautions in tandem with the falling case counts, because at some point, you could still get it, but, you know, you could run into a rabid raccoon, too. You're just not likely to, right? So, again, I think we all need situational awareness, and so in the Northeast, I feel pretty good about my parents beginning their transition back to normal living. And one of my daughters is visiting her grandparents today. And, you know, my mom is delighted to be able to hug her grandchildren. I said, yeah, fabulous. It's fine. She's not been exposed. There's very low level viral circulation in Connecticut that she could have run into. She's been careful. You've been careful. And you guys can hug. It's all good.
Do you worry about a significant second wave coming either during the summer or at the end of the summer?
In general, I'm inclined to say no. Any place that's had a meaningful first wave, I think if there is a second wave, so in other words, if the viral circulation drops over the summer and then it picks up again in the fall in a population that had significant exposure, like New York City, for example, I think the rate of infection, barring some unforeseen change in the virus, will be very low. I think the hospitalizations will be extremely low. So there, you know, there could be a little uptick that's just seasonal variation. I'm not seeing indications of a likely second wave because, again, I think much of the population has native resistance. Those who've been exposed have heightened resistance. So I think if the virus were to go away and come back, it would actually encounter a population much less vulnerable. And it might be a little bit like a typical exposure to seasonal flu. Some people get sick, most people don't. What we're seeing in much of the country now is a delayed first wave because the populations were locked down before the virus got traction there and then were let out haphazardly when the virus was still circulating. And that worries me because, you know, there are many places around the world that took a let's lock everybody in their homes approach. I worry about New Zealand, I worry about Australia. You know, when they open up, they have not prevented their share of the pandemic. They're just delaying it as long as they keep the clamps on. The minute they release the clamps, the virus will find them. So I worry very much about delayed first waves. And the ideal thing would have been, and the ideal thing still is, for us to go out into the world in waves of our own. Let's lead with the young, healthy people who can get this, make antibodies, become immune, and, you know, contribute to herd immunity. And then let's follow with slightly less young and slightly less healthy and, you know, sort of incrementally work our way to the point where the whole population can go back to normal. Those are the waves we should be thinking about because we control those waves. Whether the virus, you know, disappears during summer, comes back in the fall, we don't have direct control over that, but we have control over the way we manage our own risk. And we haven't done a very good job of that. But some of my colleagues who have spent their careers managing pandemics, they just caution me and say pandemics are capricious things. They sometimes do stuff we cannot explain. They go away, then they come back. We don't know why. We don't know why they hit hard the second time. So, you know, whatever I just said, you have to put in the context of I've got no crystal ball. I don't know for sure. But all of the data I see make me think, no, where there's been a meaningful first wave, New York City is a great example. I don't see any indication that we need to worry about a big second wave. I really don't.
David, when do you remember first becoming aware of what a serious medical issue was about to descend on the United States of America?
I wrote my first column, it may have been January. It certainly was in early February.
You know, that's very early in terms of the way the medical establishment was thinking, and for that matter, countries were thinking and politicians were thinking. So I'm sorry people didn't hear you more, because if you were talking about this in January, you were way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, and I'm looking, and it looks like it was early February. But, you know, essentially what I did, Mark, was, you know, I was watching the data out of Wuhan, and then in particular out of South Korea, which did an excellent job of active case ascertainment. They really were the first country to say, you know, rather than just guess how often this disease is lethal or how often it puts people in the hospital, in order to answer that question, we need to know how many people have it to begin with. What's the denominator? And so I started writing as soon as South Korea started producing denominator data saying 98 to 99% of all cases are mild. I said, okay, that's really important. So, you know, we've got to respect this virus. Clearly, it can kill people. On the other hand, it clearly doesn't kill most people. And in fact, most people don't get hospitalized and most people don't have a severe illness. We need to make that distinction. Who's at high risk? Who's at lower? So from the very beginning, I was saying we should be aiming to minimize total harm, think about risk stratification, get the data we need so we know what those risk tiers are, who needs our protection, who should be allowed to continue their you know, their life as they knew it before. And that narrative hasn't changed.
David, you are out of this world. You're a fabulous physician. You're a fabulous, you know, in a way, you're a scientist as well as a doctor. And you write and you're courageous and you take stands which may not be popular, and you don't seem to shy away from that. And there's so much about who you are that's been an honor for me to get to know. And you, on top of it, you are just a lovely, you're just a lovely, lovely guy. And I really hope that when all this thing is over and, you know, people are out in the world, we're not that far from each other. I really hope I get a chance to meet you in person. I'd love to meet your wife. I'd love to meet your parents as well. And, you know, at some point, David, I'll be back in the studio, our studios in Times Square area in New York. I'd love to have you at the table talking about diet and how people can stay healthy and as you view, just how you view the world. So I hope you'll let me chase you and that you will, you know, agree to be on JBS in the future. But it has been, you are spectacular. Kol tov v'hatzlacha to you. You just stay safe, you and your family, and we'll keep talking whenever we can.
Well, you've been very kind, Mark. It's been a pleasure, and absolutely. Let's follow up just as you propose. You stay safe, too.
The thoughts and insights of Dr. David Katz, a world-renowned expert in nutrition and diet, and the founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center. It was an honor having him on JBS. I hope you enjoyed learning from him. My thanks to our director, Sloan Copeland, JBS's managing director, Dara Golub, transmission manager, John McDevitt, and to the producer of this edition of Gam Yachad, Carol Lilienthal. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Stay safe and be well, my friends.